Our chalice this morning is going to be read by our speaker, Doug Kraft.
May the flame we light be a reminder of the mystery and the light that is each of us separately and all of us together.
So our presentation today is Listening Deeply, Befriending the Heart-Mind by Doug Kraft, Reverend Doug Kraft, and it's related to our third principle, acceptance of one another and encouragement in spiritual growth in our congregation. Doug Kraft got his degree in psychology at the University of Wisconsin, where he knew Bob Park, which is why we found out about Doug. And they lived together for a while at the Friends Campus Center there. Then he went to Star King to become a Unitarian Universalist minister and a psychotherapist and meditation teacher. He's published several books on Buddhist practice. He has two sons and two grandchildren, lives in Northern California near the American River with his wife and cat. So welcome, Doug.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you for including Lila, our cat. I always like to say that I like living in an interspecies family. So it's wonderful to be with you all, even if this environment still feels a little strange. Turning towards, relaxing into, deepening and savoring. So this morning, I'd like to talk about these three phrases as a form of deep listening. We can't hear deeply in others things that we can't hear in ourselves. So these three phrases outline a strategy for listening deeply in many life situations. They are helpful in light-spirited moments, and they're particularly valuable in difficult times when we're discouraged or hurt or sad or lonely or stressed. This past year has been more dire than any time I can remember, certainly my lifetime. Pandemic, racial inequalities, economic breakdown, insurrection, climate change, sociopathic president, degradation of political discourses, and on and on and on. There are great opportunities in difficult times to loosen things up so we can sometimes move more quickly, for sure. But first, we need ways to be with our individual and collective angst. So this morning, I want to focus on deep listening to ourselves so that we're better able to listen deeply to the world around us. And the strategy I want to explore is summarized by these three phrases: turning towards whatever life brings us internally or externally, relaxing into any tension that we find inside, and then deepening or looking beneath the surface to the subtle underlying roots of our experience. What's underneath our experience can be different than how it manifests on the surface, so this deepening process is important. And when it goes deeply enough, it turns into savoring. So my shorthand for all this is turning towards, relaxing into, deepening and savoring. These practices are about how we relate to ourselves. And I'm not suggesting that self is something that we are or even something that we own. I'm proposing that our sense of self is really, it's really a traveling companion. Who and what we are is completely mysterious. But we all have this itinerant chum that we hang out with and call me. We don't have full control of our thoughts or feelings or the self that moseys along with us. Just to take a simple example, right now, don't think about a blue panda. Is there a blue panda in your mind now? Did you put it there? I don't think so. I put it there by uttering the word blue panda. Can you push it out of your mind? Good luck with that. So we have influence on our thoughts and feelings and moods and walls through us, but we don't have full control. And if we don't have control of them, then they surely they're not us. They are a companion. My subtitle this morning is Befriending the Mind Heart. I'm suggesting that our sense of self arises out of our biological wiring and out of our history, and that we can enrich our lives by cultivating a clear and kind relationship with a sense of self that travels around with us. But before I make all this sound esoteric, more esoteric than it really is, might be helpful to just give you an example of how we can deepen this relationship through these practices of turning towards relaxing into deepening and savoring. Most years, I lead a 9-day meditation retreat, during which I meet with each meditator, yogis we call them, meet with each yogi or meditator every day so we can fine tune and practice. Well, there's only enough time in a day to meet individually with about 18 or 20 people, so these retreats fill up pretty quickly. So several years ago, I invited another teacher to co-lead with me. I'll call her Jill. Together, we could accept twice as many people. Several months before the retreat, when we were almost filled to capacity, Jill had an epiphany. Her epiphany was that she could not lead with me. She didn't want to have a long conversation with me about it, but she wanted me to understand her thoughts, so she sent me this long email. Her basic concern was that she didn't think I was tough enough. Retreats provide a rare opportunity to go deeper, and she felt it was important to get yogis to work hard. My experience has been that for every yogi who doesn't put enough effort into the meditation, there are about 20 who work too hard at it. Over-efforting makes the body and psyche stiffen. But if people back off and let go of the mind's stories, there's a natural peacefulness that can emerge. On the other hand, she thought that my easy and awake style would lead to mellow mush, not the clarity and precision of the Buddhist practice. Furthermore, she thought that our divergent styles would be confusing and discouraging for yogis. And she said discouraging people was, in her words, a mortal sin. That was really just her tongue-in-cheek way of saying she felt very strongly about this. Well, since she didn't want to discuss it with me, I just sent her a short note. I said that I was disappointed that it wasn't going to work out. However, if she felt that working with me would violate her integrity, I understood that she had to withdraw, and I wished her well. Doesn't that sound mature of me? I thought it sounded mature and clear and accurate and that it would bring some closure. Well, it didn't bring closure. In my next meditation, my mind rumbled incessantly. We already have more people than I can manage alone. Divergent styles are enriching. The Buddha himself taught different people in different ways. Grumble, 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 grumble. I was angrier than I realized. So I ignored the content of the rumbling and turned towards and relaxed into the anger itself, relaxed into its very center. And as I did that, it intensified. So I kept turning towards the resentment, relaxing into it, radiating kindness out into the world, only to have my mind go into another outburst. Well, I believe from years of practice that if awareness can get to the subtle conditions underneath, the tension would release. Yet after several days, my mind was still nitpicking furiously. I was stuck. There must be something I was missing. So I opened up more. And as I went more deeply into my feelings, I began to feel hurt. Deepening into the center of that hurt, there was a softer tenderness. And in the center of that tenderness was loneliness. I felt unseen. It seemed ancient, intolerable. But it was clearly there, this deep and familiar feeling of abandonment. So I relaxed into the core of this loneliness, deep listening. A week had gone by now. I was still turning towards relaxing into, and yet the rumbling and nitpicking persisted and morphed into this loneliness. So I let go of the label lonely and sunk into the felt sense of my experience. It was as if I was a piece of bamboo, hard on the outside, but hollow, dark, and dusty in the middle. And as I let down into the hollowness, a thought trickled up. The thought was, maybe Jill is right. Maybe my practice is mellow mush. Maybe my teaching and practicing are all wrong. The way my body responded to this may be surprising. A chuckle arose, and I smiled. This was the root condition of the root conditions of the root of the entire episode. I doubted my own practice down underneath it all. Worry and doubt come very easily to me, even if they hide in the shadows. My body chuckled more as it resonated with the truth of this. It was such a relief to expose the doubt at the core of my disturbance. And instantly, I knew exactly what to do. I didn't have to think about it. It was obvious. I'd conduct empirical trials. I'd practice a little harder and notice the effect. Then I'd practice a little softer and notice the effect. I didn't require anybody, any friend, any colleague, anyone else to tell me what was optimal. Frankly, I didn't even care about my own opinion. I just experiment and find out directly in my own experience. And suddenly, I didn't care what Jill or anyone else thought. I had doubt about my practice and a sure way to address the doubt. I almost laughed out loud. And I was so grateful to Jill for stimulating the inner environment that helped this clarity to surface. And as I meditated, my body and mind became very deep and peaceful as everything faded but awareness itself. And this deep calm enveloped me. Turning towards, relaxing into, deepening and savoring. Do you see how this works? This example is superficially about meditation. I spend a lot of time these days meditating or mentoring meditators. But turning towards, relaxing into, and deepening are simple and subtle and universal enough to be effective whether you meditate for 5 hours a day or 5 minutes a week. So I'd like to unpack these practices and reflect on how to use them in all kinds of situations. And as I do this, I'll give you a little bit of background about where these practices actually come from. Most scholars and students of Buddhism agree that the Four Noble Truths, the so-called Four Noble Truths, are right at the core of Buddhism and Buddhist practice. But the four aren't capital T truths. Rather, they are just simple meditation instructions based on some really very practical observations. So I refer to the first three as the three essential practices. In the Buddhist text, the first truth, or the first essential practice, is literally translated as, there is suffering. Suffering is to be understood. Notice it doesn't say life is suffering. Buddhism is misunderstood that way. It just says life has suffering. Is this news to anyone? Is there anyone here who has never suffered, never hurt or lonely or felt sad or angry or discouraged? I don't think so. So it's actually a simple, it's even an obvious observation. Life has suffering. What's important is not the observation, but what to do with it. Suffering is to be understood. Understand here doesn't refer to an intellectual analysis, but to direct intuitive knowing, deep listening. If we understand a friend, we know what lifts her up, what brings her down, what she yearns for, how she views life, and so forth. The Buddha said that we need to understand suffering deeply and intimately, like we might understand a good friend. We aren't going to understand suffering if we're busy trying to fix it, or rise above it, or push it aside, or distract ourselves from it. To understand a person or a process or ourselves, we first have to turn towards it, open up, and take it in on its own terms. Martin Heidegger, the German philosopher, wrote, "Imagine an awareness that sees into the heart of suffering with no urge to change it. And imagine this awareness is the opposite of indifference. Imagine this awareness is the essence of love." When we observe pain, suffering, angst openly, let's open up to it. We see that tension is a common element in all of it. In the Buddhist text, in the Pali, the word there is tanha. Without tension or resistance of some kind, we might experience strong sensation, but we don't actually suffer. So the second truth, the second essential practice, is literally translated using a very dramatic verb. Says there is tension. Tension is to be abandoned. You just walk away from it. How do you abandon tension? Relax. The tension might be physical or emotional or mental. It doesn't matter. We simply invite it to soften and relax. Translating this into English can be a little confusing because the verb relax in English oftentimes has an aversive connotation. Relax, man. Let it go. Push it away. Aversion is the opposite of turning towards. So I like to translate the second practice as relaxing into. We relax any tension, but it is not as a way to distance ourselves from it, but as a way to open more deeply into it. We relax into our angst or into our anger, fear, yearning, or grief, like I did with Jill with my experience of her pulling away. This relaxing into allows us to see more deeply into the experience of hurt or grief or stress to better understand it. The third noble truth, or third essential practice, takes this a step further. The language in the text is, Nirodha is to be realized. Nirodha refers to a deep sense of peace and well-being. Realize means to make it real. To let it be real, it's not enough to superficially see what's going on. We need to see into the core. We need to see deeply what's going on underneath our experience. So, for example, if we turn towards and relax into our fear or hurt or heartache, what do you see? Underneath it, almost always there's a tenderness. We aren't tender. If we were emotional brick, we wouldn't suffer. So anytime we feel distress, there's some tenderness underneath it. And then if we relax into that tenderness, there's some openness or spaciousness in there. Without that openness, there would be no tenderness. And if we relax deeply into that openness, we may experience freedom, or at least a taste of freedom. Well, we all want this freedom, this inner peace, this spiritual aliveness, this openness of being. But too often, we look for it by turning away from our difficulty, hardening against her, distracting ourselves. But it just doesn't work. Well, actually, it can work in the short run for a little bit, but it doesn't work in the long run. In the long run, that's a dead end. To find the deepest well-being, we have to turn towards, relax into, and deepen through our experience of difficulty. So the only path that works out over time goes through the suffering, the tenderness, and the openness. Into the openness rather than do an end run around this. So rather than fix, transcend, rise above, or push aside our difficulties, we can turn towards, relax into, and deepen. And when we go deep enough, the deepening turns into savoring, and we just let that well-being soak into our bones, like I did with Jill. In fact, when we turn towards and relax into, sometimes a sense of well-being comes up right away. If so, we just savor it and let it soak in. Just let it soak in. What if what comes up is uncomfortable? We turn towards and relax into and deepen until we experience the tenderness and the openness underneath. Imagine an awareness that sees into the heart of suffering with no urge to change anything. And imagine this awareness is the opposite of indifference. Neuroscientists have found that we are about four times more sensitive to pain than well-being. It's an evolutionary thing. You imagine two ancestors a million years ago walking down a path, and there's a cave bear over there, and there's some fruit over there. The one who is more tuned into the good feelings ignores the bear, eats the fruit, and gets eaten by the bear. The one who's more sensitive to the pain deals with the bear, maybe attacks it, maybe runs away, but tries to deal with it first and comes back and gets the food later. We inherited his or her genes. Since we're more sensitive to pain than well-being, the Buddha suggests that when we experience even a little bit of uplift, even a little taste, it helps to realize it by deepening into it or savoring it and just being with it. So in just a few minutes, I'd like to open it up for questions and comments. But maybe before we do this, would you like to try these practices out for a few moments? Okay, if you would, I think the rest of us are going to do it. So if you don't, you can find a book. But if you'd like to just join into this, think of some situation in your life that you're uncomfortable with. Could be something big or small. It might be in relationships or emotions or how you feel about the world, what it's like to be cooped up in a pandemic, or some sense of failure or letdown. Could be anything that pulls your spirits down. And then close your eyes or let them come to rest someplace in distraction and bring to heart some of the experience of suffering in your life. Don't try to think about it or analyze it. Those can be helpful in some situations, but our thoughts can also be quite gullible. So instead, just feel yourself into the situation by simply turning towards it in your mind and heart. And opening up to it. Just let it be as it is. And whatever feelings come up, simply notice if there is any tension in them. Don't try to change the situation in which you feel. Just notice any tension, pushing or pulling or thickness in the mind or heart. And if you see some, just gently invite it to soften. Just relax into it. Notice if there's any tenderness underneath. And if so, relax into that tenderness. Notice if there's any openness or spaciousness beneath tenderness. And if so, relaxed into that sense of space. And let that spaciousness soak into your being, savor it. May it be so. Blessed be. Namaste.
Well, thank you so much, Doug. And Doug is going to read the closing words.
May we turn towards whatever life brings us, relax into our experience, and savor any uplift, no matter how small or large. May it be so. Blessed be.
Thank you so much.